Today on Life and Faith.
I mean, you talked about the darkness of contemporary art, you know, fiction or television or film. I mean, to me, the heart of the human condition is that somehow mysteriously, wonderfully, we are both glories and shames. As one person put it, we are glorious ruins as human beings.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Today we're featuring a conversation I had with Stephen Garber on his recent trip to Australia. Stephen Garber is the Professor of Marketplace Theology and Leadership at Regent College in Vancouver, where I happened to study theology, but before Stephen was there. Stephen's also the founder of the Washington Institute for Faith, Vocation and Culture in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a number of books, including Visions of Vocation and The Fabric of Faithfulness. He's a fascinating person with captivating stories, and this discussion covers philosophy and culture and faith, as well as a good dose of pop and rock music references. We'll talk 21 Pilots, The Smashing Pumpkins, U2, and ask, are we amusing ourselves to death? It's well worth a listen. Here it is. Stephen Garber, thanks so much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Now, you've written about the way people's worldview changes and is impacted by big cultural shifts across history. Why is worldview an important concept to get our heads around? Because people don't typically walk around thinking about, oh, what is my worldview?
Because we all see the world in certain ways. One of my own teachers wrote about having pre-theoretic commitments, which is a very important idea to get a hold of because it's the insight, the argument would be, is that before we even begin to think, to theorize, we've already committed ourselves. So because we, as human beings, see out of our hearts the deepest reality of what it means to be a human being, what we see, what we hear, what we feel really grows out of what we believe to be true about reality. So that's why it matters.
What might be an example to help us out here of what's meant by worldview or story that we live by? So what are some examples of how you come to that commitment with a whole lot of things that you believe to be true about the world?
Well, the stories could go on, or the examples are endless almost, but here's one that I've long thought about. One of my children is now an almost 40-year-old son, and he was in veterinary school some years ago and won a fellowship with the National Institute of Health to go to India for a year of study in Vellore in the south of India. And I visited him for about 10 days while he was there and drove around with him in the south part of India, Kerala, among other places. And I was just watching. I was thinking about what I was seeing. And the last day I was there, we were going to the airport, I said to him, Elliot, why is it that every hospital I see has some kind of Christian symbol on it? It's either a Red Cross on it or it's called St. George's Hospital. But why is that? And I had my own sort of wondering assumption about it, but I wonder what he would think. And he gave a nuanced, thoughtful answer. I've met a lot of good people this year, many really good Hindus, generous people. But he said, you know, Hinduism, of course, teaches karma. It's the heart of the worldview, to use that word here. It's the heart of the story. So that Hindu culture, as he put it, doesn't make hospitals. Because, you see, if you have your karma, I have my karma, your situation does not implicate me. I'm not responsible. I can't change your situation.
Nor should I, right?
Nor should I, actually. Right. So it was intriguing to me just to see a story being played out culturally like that.
Is it always a religious question then, worldview, or is it more complicated than that?
I think we are profoundly, though we mostly don't talk this way or see things this way, I think we all are profoundly religious people in that deepest sense, actually. We are homo adorans, to use the Latin here. We will care most about something. We will commit ourselves most deeply to something. Homo adorans, we will adore something. We'll make something most important to us.
I was wondering about this idea of story, or whether that whether that resonates with you at all. But is the worldview or our story something that makes sense of our lives, our hopes, our fears, our disappointments, our joys? Is it a way of interpreting the world?
It is always that, actually, whether you own that or not, whether you're self-conscious or not of that. I mean, whether you're still a Maoist somehow lingering in contemporary China, whether you're a Hindu or a Buddhist, or whether you're a secular materialist, or, you know, whether you're a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian. I mean, everybody sees, hears, feels life like that.
Now, you've had moments in your life, especially when you were younger, where you had your worldview challenged, and you were having to really work it out. Now, but when I was reading about your story, I was wondering about whether we are as a culture at risk of not ever even getting to think as deeply as that these days. Our culture seems to be marked by triviality.
By triviality. Given that I am an American and lived for 30 years in Washington, D.C., when Neil Postman wrote in the mid-1980s, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Television, it was a profound assessment of the mid-1980s. 1984 was the book published, actually, of course, and he was looking at these two futurologists early in the 20th century, Orwell and Huxley, asking who won.
Yeah.
You know, and he argues, I think, with insight and with eloquence, actually, with a remarkable understanding of what was going on, that Huxley won. That we were going to amuse ourselves to death instead. Now, it was appropriate and insightful and a book for its moment. I would say 30 years later, it's even more appropriate, more insightful, more perceptive, because what happened in American politics clearly, and what happened in British politics, you know, we can kind of look at the world in some ways, but at least in the Western, in the West, we call the West, you know, I would say there's clearly a movement towards that more and more and more.
You also write in your book, Visions of Vocation, that the musicians, the artists, the musicians, the playwrights, the filmmakers are the ones we should listen to because, as you put it, they get there first in terms of a cultural critique and understanding. What's your sense of what the artists are telling us today about how the world is and how it ought to be?
In some ways, of course, it depends which one you're going to listen to, and, you know, you could look all around. I had a pleasure the other day speaking to educators throughout Sydney of talking about some of Australia's best films, which I happen to have seen over the years.
Okay.
But 2 weeks ago, I went to a concert in Vancouver at the request of a long friend of mine who is the business manager for a group of two guys whose music is rocking the world right now. They call themselves the 21 Pilots.
Okay.
And they've been here in Sydney in the last year or so. Mm. But their music in the last year or two has been literally the biggest music in the world.
Really?
Literally, it has been, actually.
Somehow missed the Pilots.
Well, it's hard to keep up, I would say. It's very hard to keep up. But the biggest song on the biggest album of the year, the first album in rock history for every song on the album to become platinum. It's amazing to hear that. It's called Stressed Out. And the biggest song on the album, Stressed Out, is principally for 15, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, actually. That's who's listening to it. That's what's making them so globally famous. So it's interesting to hear that, you know, in a moment in history we think, well, you know, kids are so cared for and we're doing everything we possibly could to make sure that they have soft landings in the world and, you know, all the soccer games and all the educational resources and everything we're doing to make sure that they have a happier than we had life as a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old. It's amazing to think that this band, with its finger to the pulse, what it feels like to be adolescent in the world today, they would make the most money of anybody in music with a song called Stressed Out.
Do you have a sense of why that is? I mean, it does seem like a very anxious generation, a stressed out generation. Do you have any feel for why that might be?
I think the part of what is a strange phenomenon right now, if you take this, move from the 21 Pilots singing their music all over the arenas and venues all over the world, go to MIT, a professor named Sherry Turkle, who in the last year or two has become more and more well-known because we're living more and more with this, you know, connected society that the internet brings about, as we call it. We know everybody, you know, and everybody knows us. But she has a book which is I actually assigned to my students at Regent College that's called Alone Together.
Because I think we're setting ourselves up for trouble. Trouble certainly in how we relate to each other, but also trouble in how we relate to ourselves, in our capacity for self-reflection. We're getting used to a new way of being alone together. People want to be with each other, but also elsewhere, connected to all the different places they want to be. People want to customize their lives. They want to go in and out of all the places they are because the thing that matters most to them is control over where they put their attention.
And her argument is, it's with great insight, and she's brilliant and perceptive, but she says, we live in a moment where we are alone together, you know, where, you know, you could walk down the middle of the University of British Columbia campus, as I have done day by day, or bicycle by through the, on a Saturday morning, and incredibly see every group of two female undergraduates, or three or four male undergraduates, or a family with grandparents and parents and children. Every group I saw one Saturday morning, actually people were walking along looking at their cell phones. Yeah. So they were together, but they were alone. Yes. And Terkel gets that, really. So somehow, I mean, part of what's going on is that we are, you know, we're living into a moment which we never lived into before, actually.
On today's episode of Life and Faith, we're talking to Stephen Garber. Stephen is a teacher and consultant, the author of many books. And he's particularly interested in people's worldviews, or if you like, the story that we all live by, and how that might impact our sense of faith, hope, and meaning. How do we see the world and our place in it? And what do we do with what we know? And in this part of the interview, I mentioned to Stephen that something we've looked at and written about at CPX is the tendency for some of the best television, some of the best literature in recent years to be very dark. There seems to be a lack of redemptive possibilities in much of this work. And I asked Stephen whether he thought the absence of God in people's lives in our culture was in any way related to the hopelessness that many people seem to feel. When he gave his answer, Stephen mentioned someone who's been a huge influence on him, the Czech writer and politician Václav Havel. Here's Stephen Garber again.
3 years ago, I was invited by some people in Bratislava, Slovakia, to come speak for several days, actually out of this book, Visions of Vocation. They said, we've been reading your book. Would you come and speak about what a renewal of vocation might mean for the recovery of the health of our societies? I decided to fly into Prague to begin all this because I've been quite a student of Václav Havel for quite some time, actually. At the heart of his work, he made the argument that the secret of man is the secret of his responsibility. So that really has intrigued me, and I've been thinking about that quite deeply for many years now. But he began to say in the 1980s, not as somebody of Christian faith, for example, but simply as what I would call an honest human being, in some ways echoing Nietzsche from a century and a half earlier, which is fascinating to think about. Here's Nietzsche, the father of contemporary atheism, who says, I'm part of all this. I am leading the way, actually, but let's be honest about it. If we give up on God, let's stop talking, because we must stop talking about both meaning and morality. So here's Havel a century and a half later coming into out of prison, becoming the president inexplicably in a month afterwards of the Czech Republic, you know, at the time. And he begins to speak all over the world, saying out loud to audiences wherever he was invited, which he was everywhere, people wanted to hear him. He said, if we lose God in the world today, this end of the 20th century, we have to stop talking about meaning and purpose and accountability and responsibility. Now, I would say most people don't want to own that, but I would say he had profound insight into metaphysical reality. So.
Now, you say that, well, you were quoting Walter Percy in your book when you say the novelist is the physician of the soul, and then we go on to say, bad books always lie, and they lie most of all about the human condition. Oh, I love that.
I do too.
Now, what do you think are the most critical aspects of the human condition for someone to understand? Like, what are we touching on there?
I mean, you talked about the darkness of contemporary art, you know, fiction or television or film. I mean, to me, the heart of the human condition is that somehow mysteriously, wonderfully, we are both glories and shames. As one person put it, we are glorious ruins as human beings. So somehow, to me, that has to be captured somehow in the work. Percy himself was somebody who was identified when he first won the National Book Award for Fiction with The Moviegoer, you know, the New York literati who were watching all this and making the pronouncements. He won the big award of the year for the best book. And they said, we have our own Camus now, finally, in America. And he says, no, you miss me, actually. He says, I look the bleakness of the human condition right in the eye. I'm honest about that. But there's always a hint of hope in my work, too. So somehow, how do you hold on to both being honest about who we are, the ruin, the shame of being human in the world, but also a hint of hope that's honest about, you know, our aspirations, sort of the wonder of being human, the glory of being a human being? That's the more difficult task of art.
Yes, and you identify two typical responses to life's deep sorrows, being cynicism or stoicism. And you're saying that neither of those are the most helpful thing.
Yeah. Well, I would say the primordial temptation, actually, given my own tradition and commitments, grows out of this strangely named tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the very beginning of the Bible.
Yeah.
And I've called it an epistemological temptation with a moral heart.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is it's the question coming from Genesis chapter 3, what are you going to do with what you know? What will you do with what you know? And realizing that from that moment on, human beings have been faced with that question all day long, when they wake up in the morning to they go to bed at night. And thousands of years ago, literally thousands of years ago, people began to identify themselves self-consciously, naming themselves, I am a Stoic, naming themselves, I am a Cynic. This is thousands of years ago. I would say that they're twin sides of the same response to that first, that primordial temptation, that primordial question, because they both want to suppress the hurt, the responsibility of what they know, because it costs too much, it hurts too much, actually.
Yeah.
And we don't want to have to deal with that kind of hurt in life.
What's the alternative that's more hopeful?
Yeah. Well, what I have come to believe, actually, is that it actually grows out of the Hebrew and Christian tradition in a unique way, in a remarkably unique way, frankly, because it argues that to know means to be responsible. To know means to love, actually. So I use the language oftentimes, learning from Havel, but also learning from the Hebrew Christian tradition, that the key issue is, can you see yourself as responsible for love's sake, for the way of the world, for the way the world is and ought to be?
Tell me, why is it good news for someone to consider the idea that there is actually a God behind the universe, that the universe, as some people have said, is created on love and not chaos? Why does that impact anyone's life?
Well, it's such a good question, really, and there's no cheap answer to that question, actually. I mean, I would never say that it's a cheap answer to that question, but it's a good conversation to have, a serious conversation to have. So in the Christian tradition, there is a rich word called call, which is call or calling. Well, obviously the Hebrew Christian tradition assumes a caller when we begin to use the word call or calling.
So when people use language like, I feel called to be a teacher, or I feel called to be an architect, or whatever it might be. Yeah, it's a great concept, right?
So actually,
there needs to be a caller.
Well, there has to be, if you're going to sort of think through logically, there has to be a caller. But in a godless world, which is, again, why I'm so drawn to Havel's honesty, in a godless world, let's stop talking about meaning, purpose, accountability, responsibility, because it's really just up to you to do what you want to do with your life. And who are you to say to somebody else, you shouldn't do that? And because, of course, there's no moral universe for which any of us are accountable or responsible. It's simply up to me.
But some people might think of that as an enormously freeing thing, because I don't have responsibility anymore.
Some years ago, the biggest, you know, music in the world for a brief shining moment was from the Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, yeah.
And I took my sons to one of their concerts one time, and I left them with their friends just to kind of enjoy it. And I kind of walked around the giant arena with thousands of, you know, Virginia teenagers. And Billy Corgan, of course, was the iconic lead of the band, and he had a black T-shirt on. And, you know, rather than the last moment of the concert, which was when I was an 18-year-old going to hear Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, the climactic moment was him, you know, playing the Star Spangled Banner with his teeth and then smashing his guitar on the stage and going off and smoke his dope or something. Yeah. You know, this climactic moment was about a third of the way through the concert, actually. It was a song called Zero. And Billy had his black T-shirt with the word Zero across the chest, really. When I got home, and the famous line from that song is, "And God is empty just like me." You know, we went home that night with my sons in different rooms so they couldn't hear each other. I said, "What do you think about the concert? What happened?" And I said, "What was the big point?" And they both said, "And God is empty just like me." I remember saying to them, you know, it's ironic to me that the Pumpkins, as they were, you know, shorthand called, are making millions of dollars week after week with their music, with nihilism being the heart of the music. I said, they won't be able to keep doing this, you know. And they were perplexed by that, like, they're the biggest thing in the world right now. mean, I said they can't sustain it, of course, because how could you sustain that with nihilism? And of course, they didn't. And the next concert tour they were on, they actually paid for the venues with their receipts from the box offices, and then gave everything else away. And then they broke up the next year.
Now, you had a moment in your life after the awful murder of a friend, where you really did wonder whether your faith could adequately deal with that kind of sorrow, that sort of jolting sorrow, to be able to sustain faith and hope in the face of really what a brutal realities of life, and in this case came home very, very largely to you. What brought you to the point where you thought actually it could sustain those things? I'm sure that wasn't a quick thing.
No, it wasn't really at all. I was teaching university students in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, actually, and so I was about in my mid-30s at the time, and I remember thinking, after, you know, in the next day or two after this news had just completely shocked me, pushed me back to the edge of my life, really, thinking, maybe this is enough. Maybe this is finally it. I've been sort of living with a certain set of beliefs about how things should be and could be in the world, but I don't know. Maybe this is just finally it. I don't know that I want to go on. If this happens in this world, I don't know that I want to keep believing what I've always believed to be true. And, you know, in my own tradition, the fathers and mothers of the centuries have called this the dark night of the soul. And I would say it was that for me, just a very dark night of my soul. I remember reading that month a Harper's Magazine cover story, an interview with Camille Paglia, the feminist philosopher, and Neil Postman, interestingly. And Harper's had paid for a very fancy 10-course dinner for the two of them to talk about the meaning of television in life. And Camille Paglia had TVs on in every room of her house all the time. Postman, of course, with his own critique of a television-based society. And, well, after the seventh or eighth course or so, they're talking about deeper, deeper things, of course. And Postman makes the argument about our observation, saying, you know, reading papers these days, there's an illogic in my students' presentations. They jump from this to this. He says it's really a lot like TV, actually. You just sort of jump from just this to this. And Camille Paglia says, oh, Neil, come on. That's just life, you know. He says, no, it can't be, because how can you watch the television and, you know, hear about an earthquake in Chile and an airplane crash in India and a rape in Central Park and then watch an ad for toothpaste, you know. And she says, Neil, that's just the way it is. Buddha smiles at it all. And I remember thinking those words. I remember the feeling I had reading those words that day, thinking, no. No, no. I mean, if that's the alternative, Buddha smiles at it all, I can't go there, so where am I going to go then? And for me, it was really a digging away in a deeper, new way in my life. Well, what then do I believe about these deepest things?
Yeah, and what did you come to? Like, what does Christian faith say in the face of these awful realities? I mean, holding those things together, and you've mentioned both, you know, the wonders and the joys of life, but also the terrible realities as well.
Well, for me, actually, I've been pretty interested in this question of what does it mean to know for a long time. Simone Weil, the great French philosopher, the last night of her life, wrote these words on her journal. These were the last words she wrote before she died. The most important task of teaching is to teach what it means to know. Well, I've been intrigued by that idea for most of my life now. What does it mean to know? And, of course, the question of, you know, the dark night of my soul was, can I know this wounded, hurting, broken, sad world and still care about it, you know? And so for me, I began to go back into my own deepest sources of my soul, actually. And I was frankly drawn to the story of Jesus with the death of his friend Lazarus. What began to interest me about this story was this, that when he comes to this little village on his way to his own death the next week, literally. The text in the Greek, which I'm not a Greek scholar, but I get some of these things like all of us can. Actually, the language is used twice in that story in John chapter 11. And he groaned deeply in his spirit. It's the same word that's used, actually, by Greek poets to describe a war stallion on its hind legs, its front legs pawing the air, its nostrils flared out, ready to charge into battle. That's the same word that John uses to describe Jesus groaning deeply in his spirit. So it's not only, you know, sympathetic with Mary and Martha for the death of their brother, which he was. He did weep. That's the language, that short verse, Jesus wept. But more importantly in some ways to me is he groaned deeply in his spirit. He was angry at what had happened in the world, the hurt and the wrong and the brokenness and the death of the world. God himself was angry at it. And in some ways, I would say, Simon, that for the rest of my life, I do see life this way, actually. If that wasn't true, that isn't true, I would not want to be a Christian, actually. I wouldn't want to believe what Christians say they believe to be true, because it's really a line in the sand for me. If God doesn't see the world that way, then I'm frankly not interested.
You write about paying attention to what really matters in life. And you're big on this notion of transcendence and the linking of the material world with the non-material. Why is that so important, and why is that kind of an energizing, uplifting idea? Because people these days tend to, at one level, deny transcendence and at least speak as if they believe in a sort of hard materialism. And yet you see everywhere this hunger for transcendence.
One of your own philosophers in Australia is Peter Singer.
Yes.
And it was an interesting cover article, essay in The New Yorker some years ago called The Most Dangerous Philosopher in the World, about Peter Singer, actually. And it's about 10 pages of, you know, of fascinating, thoughtful, insightful analysis of Peter Singer's thinking, people he knows, people who know him. And given my own pilgrimage over the years, I spent some part of my life at a place called La Brie many years ago. And this idea that you could ask an honest question, get an honest answer, was really important to me. And Francis Schaeffer talked about presuppositions, and he would sort of push people to think through, what do you believe? What's it going to mean, actually? Well, this essayist in the article in The New Yorker, no references to Francis Schaeffer at all, but you could just see him pressing Peter Singer in terms of his pre-theoretic commitments or his presuppositions about everything and what he argues for about human beings. Well, for years, Peter Singer has argued that we are just like pigs, basically, as human beings. And if a pig gets, you know, too old and diseased and no longer productive, well, you just get rid of it, actually. He's been saying this out loud with sophistication to audiences and universities all over the world for years now. The last page of the essay has the writer says, well, what about your own mother, Peter? You and your sister have decided, you know, to take care of her because now she has Alzheimer's and she can't really take care of herself anymore. And of course, you've been writing about this for years now and saying when that happens to somebody, where they shoot horses, don't they? You know, I mean, why are you caring for your mother like this? It's not quite what you've been arguing for everybody else. The last paragraph literally says this. Peter Singer quoting him right now. He says, well, maybe, perhaps it's more difficult than I imagined, because you see, it's different when it's your own mother.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to be said for that, isn't it? But it's this urging people to think through the implications of their belief.
I think because, I mean, again, not because people are malicious about this, typically at least, but I think that we have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
We're in the year of the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And it strikes me that at that point of humanity's, perhaps up to that point, greatest ever scientific achievement, you have this sort of existential, poetic, sort of people reaching for language that would describe something well beyond the material. I think that's an interesting phenomenon, don't you? And it speaks to our desire for something more than what we can measure and see and touch.
I think it does. I actually think it does. And I think that, you know, I've been a great lover of U2's music for many, many years now, of course, and gone to many concerts and listened to much, you know, of their work for decades, really, and even talked sometimes to some of the people in the band about what they do and why they do what they do. It's uncanny to think about the music they've done because, you know, I'll put it in American terms. I'm not sure what the particular beer would be here in Australia, but if you can imagine people coming to these concerts and raising their plastic cups of Coors overhead and singing the songs of Zion. How long, O Lord, to sing this song? And you think, so what have you guys done there, Bono and his buddies, you know, to actually sing songs that somehow are about the deepest longings of the human heart? Because you watch the audiences at your concert and everyone's singing every word of every song. You think, so what is it about this that you've been able, in my own language, Simon, to translate, to sing songs shaped by the truest truths of the universe in language the whole world can understand.
This has been Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Thanks for listening. And thank you to Stephen Garber for his generosity in giving his time and also something of his story. Stephen was here in Australia for Anglican Edcom, speaking at their conference in Sydney. If you liked what you heard today, and if you haven't already, do subscribe to Life and Faith and give it a rating on iTunes. Also, share it with those you think might enjoy it too. Coming up next week...
We trust in what we have. We build up our image based on what we look like and what we own and how we dress. And then there's just an emptiness inside. But we need to be able to open our eyes and be receptive to the reality of injustice in our world. For one, being aware of the needs of others, just linking in to see the way other people live can be a challenge to us and say, well, what exactly is happening here if I have so much and most people have so little?